I'm from Chicago, and I've been here at Holden a lot. In the 70s, we were here for seven straight summers, and in 84, we came back. My wife came in 83. I came with her in 84. In 89 and 90, we were here for 21 months. And we were here last year for 3 weeks, and now we're here again. So that there's a sense in which Holden has really been a part of our life. And I wouldn't say it's responsible for what we are, but it's been a very, very important aspect of our life. The subject today is the second in a series. The first was the environmental revolution as the voice of God. And in it, I was trying to show that if you listen to what's going on in the environment, if you listen hard enough, you get the sense that God is trying to say something. And if you look at some of the New Old Testament passages, you will find that there God uses nature, actually, and there are several of them, and I might just call your attention to one or two of them, which indicate that in the Old Testament way of looking at things, for example, in Ezekiel says that you commit abominations and each of you defiles his neighbor's wife. Thus says the Lord, as I live, surely those who are in the waste places shall fall by the sword, and him that is in the open field I will give to the beasts to be devoured, and those who are in strongholds and in caves shall die by pestilence. And I will make the land a desolation and a waste, and her proud might shall come to an end. And the mountains of Israel shall be so desolate that none will pass through. Then you will know that I am the Lord, when I have made the land a desolation and a waste because of all their abominations which they have committed. That's a pretty hard thing to accept, that God actually uses nature, that is the non-human world, to send a message to people about how they're living, about what they're doing with their lives. And I could go on to other passages in which the same Isaiah 55 says the same thing, that the claim is that there that you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. That's a positive notion, that if you are faithful, the natural world will respond. The point I was trying to make last time was that if you look at what's happening in the environment, if you look at the ozone depletion, and you look at the climate change, it's tempting to think that somehow this present wetness and this present heat is due to climate change, although I just read a piece in the New York Times which suggests that it's due to Pinatubo in the Philippines, with all of the ash that's come up, which has cooled and it has cooled the climate and changed the prevailing winds and what's happened in the climate. But the article says as soon as the effect of the ash is over and it's slowly dying down, then the warming that is found to be taking place in the atmosphere will continue. There's a great debate about global warming, but the forests are being destroyed. And in some parts of the world, of course, the floods are due to the fact that the forests have been destroyed, and the floods come because that there's no way to absorb the water in the hills. And I was watching a faculty person at the University of Chicago describe what happened in Morocco, and when they cultivated the hills, the erosions took place, and now in many parts of northern Morocco, all they have are bare rocks because they cultivated too much, because the population pressure pushed them into cultivating much more thoroughly and without concern for the kinds of soil that would retain the water. At any rate, the point I was making last time was that from my point of view, we're in for real trouble. We have the toxic wastes like the tailings here. We spent $3 million trying to do something with the toxic waste so that they wouldn't drain into Railroad Creek and therefore drain down into to Lake Chelan, the toxic cyanide and other things that were used in their copper mining and gold mining. And they say that it'll take $500 billion to take care of the toxic waste. And if we add the military waste, it'll take $5 trillion to provide some protection so these toxic wastes will not result in all kinds of cancer and other problems for our health. It's a long story, and I don't mean to develop it today, but what I was saying last time was that if you look at what is happening to the environment, then you are almost forced to ask questions about why it is happening. And what is it about our life that causes this to happen? And there are many, many interpretations, and some say it is simply because we do not use efficient machinery, that the Japanese and the Germans get twice as much GNP for every kilowatt of energy they use, because they use it efficiently, and we could use it efficiently, and we could reduce our use of fossil fuels, and we could reduce the threat of carbon dioxide for global warming if we would institute those policies. But one of our problems is that we don't have any way of instituting those policies, particularly because we are prejudiced against the intervention of political forces. And in Germany and in the Scandinavian countries, Japan, they're less prejudiced, and so they've introduced devices. They've introduced taxes. Most of the European nations spend $4 a gallon for their gasoline, but we're having a problem right now in this country with getting a tax of, what is it, 4.33%, I think it is, that's now being suggested by Clinton and company. At any rate, my hypothesis is that God is saying something to us, that there's a structure to the universe, and there are rhythms that have been established and are broken only at peril of life itself, and that climate change is a very, very disastrous affair, as you can see from what's happening now in terms of its destructiveness. And the theory is that with the warming of the Earth, the chief warming will take place at the equator. The difference in the temperature between the equator and the poles will be much larger, and that will cause the turbulence, winds, storms will increase in intensity, and all kinds of changes will occur in terms of rainfall and in terms of temperature. so that there'll be drought, and they point to the summer of 1988, which was very, very warm, as an indication of the kind of thing that will happen. And the growing seasons will move north so that the great central plains will no longer be the places where wheat is produced, but it will be in northern United States and in Canada and in Siberia that the growing will be kind of temperature and weather that will promote the growing. At any rate, my thesis last time was that if you listen, and I've just written a book called Listen to the Crying of the Earth. If you listen to the earth, to what's happening, to what the scholars are saying, and they differ. There's considerable difference in what they're saying. But if you listen and you ask yourself, why is it happening and what does it say about the way in which we are ordering our lives, you get different messages. But I get a very strong no to much of what is going on in the United States and in the Western culture. I get a very strong no. We can't continue to do what we have been doing. And from my study, I would say we have at most 100 years of oil left. And maybe we have 200, but we have limited supplies. And it just doesn't make any sense not to use our oil efficiently. I have a study which indicates that we could cut our fossil fuels one half with energy efficiency with the support of energy alternatives, that is renewable sources. We could cut another half, and that would mean we'd be using one quarter of the amount of fossil fuels for the same amount of industrial output that we have now. Now, why don't we do that? That's one of the questions I think we have to ask ourselves. Why is it that this which seems so rational to do, and which the rest of the world is doing, and which the rest of the world is doing with a resultant superior competitive position in relationship to our industry, why don't we do it? And that suggests that there's an ethos, that there's a way of looking at life here, that there's a whole series of issues rooted in our fundamental way of being. And I've said just recently that the fundamental issue is that we think we are kind of isolated individuals, whereas if we take, I think, the biblical picture of reality seriously, we are individuals in community. We take 1 Corinthians 12 seriously. We're parts of a body, and like a body, everything that happens to any part of it happens to us. And if we take that image and we use that image in thinking about what to be and do, then we would be and do quite differently from what we are. Well, essentially, that was what I was talking about, is the Word of God. The Word of God is a word which says we belong to each other. We're not acting as if we belong to each other. We're allowing 40,000 kids to die every day from hunger. We're allowing all kinds of problems in the world. And in allowing those, we are really disregarding the creation, disregarding the created order of being, disregarding the way in which God has created us to be for and with and in communion with each other. And for the most part, we are for ourselves or for our families, or very limited parts of reality, and that we therefore are disobeying the created intention of the Creator, and the inevitable result will be judgment and destruction of life. And what What I'm going to try to do today is to show how, from my point of view, and it's only my point of view, the poverty and the violence that's occurring is the same kind of a word. You can come out of our relation to people, you can come out of our relationship to the non-human world, to the physical, chemical, biological ground or cradle for our lives, and you get the same word, at least I get the same word, that we need to reconceive, reconsider, rethink, re-be. And that means that we change a great deal of the way we work and think and are in life. Well, that's the general thesis, and whether I get through this or not, I'm not sure. But why don't I just say a few words about how I came to think about all of this. I've been Minister for Social Concerns in a UCC, United Church of Christ, and the Disciples Church in Chicago for 18 years. And I've been a member of and a founder of and a supporter of an intentional Christian community in Chicago where we live in a 20-flat building together and have a covenanted life, and we've got about 60 people united and in this community. And I've been very active in the civil rights movement in Chicago. I worked for Jesse Jackson for 7 years in his Operation Push, and I was really the kind of Chicago support with an African-American leader when King was in Chicago, so that I was very much a part of King's Northern campaign. I've been in the black community for 30 years, so that reality is very much a part of my background. Let's see, I have 5 kids from 15 to 52 and 9 grandkids, to get to some of the important aspects. I've been a member of this church 18 years. I was a member of another church 23 years before that. I believe in the church. I believe very firmly in being a part of a community and trying to do whatever one can. I taught at the University of Chicago for quarter of a century in Christian social ethics, and I came up here in 89 after I'd retired. Actually retired in 78, so it was a good deal after I retired, and began to work on the environment. And so I've done nothing really since 89 except read and think and pray about the environment, write, and try to get people to think about it, churches think about it, and think about it as a responsibility for the creation, and so I call it on cultivating a creation community, so that it's creation awareness in the church life, because of all the groups in the country, I think the church is the one that has the most grounding in a notion that there is a created structure to life, and that that's what we ought to think about and ought to relate to, and with all the problems, because there are various interpretations of what it means to be take the Creator seriously, as you are well aware. At any rate, what I want to talk about today is the situation with regard to violence and poverty. We had a forum actually Thursday night on violence, and there's no question that in our cities, the violence is erupting. When the Bulls won the championship, they were shooting outside our window. Our son was out on the porch, and we just had to pull him back in because the least provocation, people seem to shoot. And it's hard to understand. And yet there is this kind of violence in people. I remember one of my fraternity brothers saying that he likes to take japs by the neck and just choke them when they got them in their prisoners of war. And it's very hard to understand people like that. I worked with a couple of people who were violent. Nobody had any truth except them. Everybody had bad motives and was out to, you know, do bad, actually, to undermine them and to undermine all the things they were interested in. And I was stupid, without any capacity or any ability to do anything right. And they always assumed these bad motives on the part of other people. They assumed you had to confront people with power. You had to threaten them if you wanted them to take you into account, that they weren't persons of goodwill with good intentions and that you could converse with them. And I developed a whole theory about violent people out of this experience. And the theory I had was that the violence is due to the fact that they disrespect themselves. They disrespect themselves, and then they disrespect other people. And as you well know, there's all kinds of violence being done against people. It's hard to understand why. In Chicago, we read now that fathers and friends of mothers and all kinds of people take a baby and shake the baby until the baby is dead. Why people are so frustrated that they do this kind of thing is partially understandable in terms of the state of the world, and that's a little bit about what I want to talk today. On the other hand, it's hard to put oneself in the place of one of those persons where they would shoot somebody for no good reason or shake them or really lead to their deaths. But some people say that it's kind of deep within us, and they try to make the case that we're part of the whole animal kingdom in which violence is a part. Other people say, well, there are only two species that are really as violent with each other as we are. One that's rats. Rats are violent and will destroy their own species, but especially if clans or what do they call it, packs. They destroy another pack, not their own, but the same author that I was reading, Lorenz, on aggression, says that most animals will protect their species, that there's a limit to how much they'll fight with their own species, and they will give signs which will indicate that they give up, and then they are, the attack stops. But we don't. And it's very, very hard to understand. Other people dispute that, but I'm only saying that you've got to try to get some idea of why people are so violent. Why Los Angeles? I was out on the west side in Chicago the night that King was murdered, and it was just it was just like packs. It's just like shorebirds, they were just rushing all over everywhere, just irrational, without any rational way of understanding, what, from my point of view, what was going on. except they were expressing something. This violence is increasing, and we have various statistics to show that they're increasing. The Chicago Tribune now carries every day a little box in which the number of children who have been killed during the year are in that box, and almost every day you have a new child that's killed by somebody shooting. And I know that it is asserted by some that the black community is more prone to violence than the white community. I don't know that the statistics would bear that out, although certainly there are some statistics which bear out the fact that there's more kind of frustration and rage in the black community than there is in other communities. Although in Los Angeles, it is asserted by a writer whose book I have here, black writer, that only 37% of the persons arrested in the Los Angeles riots were African Americans, which would suggest that the kind of spontaneous and irresponsible expression of anger is society-wide and not located there. Well, Cornel West, in this book called Race Matters, discusses the situation of the blacks particularly, and he indicates that, so far as he can see, one of the reasons that this is happening is that our social system, our society, is not really providing services and opportunities for people. That increasingly there's an absence of jobs. And there's an increasing more absence of jobs for African Americans than there is for other people. And education in the, particularly in the urban centers, is what he calls decrepit. That is, it's not very adequate, and you can get all kinds of figures. The Children's Defense Fund put out this report on the extent to which those who were in poverty are more likely to drop out of school. So that if you've lived in poverty 3 to 7 years, 27.7% drop out of school. If you've lived in poverty, the children have lived in poverty 8 or more years, 42.2% of the children drop out of school. I mean, it's just statistics that the living in poverty, and that 1 out of 2 black children live in poverty now. 1 out of 5 children in the United States live in poverty. 2 out of 5 Hispanic children live in poverty. That and if these statistics on dropping out of school are correct, then they're likely to drop out of school. And if they drop out of school, of course, their chance of getting a job, a decent job, is very little, and even getting a job anymore is very little, as the industrial sector, particularly in the cities, is vanishing as the jobs are moving to Korea and to Mexico and to Hong Kong and to where else are they moving? They're moving around the world. And so that if you don't have the education, Tidbits gets his health benefits the rest of his life, and he gets a little bit of money when he's 55. He's now 48. And what was it, 130,000 were let out, and they're planning to let out another 100,000. So one of the things I learned and read frequently about Germany after the First World War was that our decision to force the Germans into reparations, that is, into making up for what they had helped destroy, wiped out the middle class. In other words, the middle class lost its security and economic income. And everyone that I've ever read says that it's what's important is to have an increasing income and status and opportunity. But if you decrease people's status, it really does affect their whole mental attitude toward life. So that insofar as we are now participating in the deindustrialization of this country, we are likely to see a great deal of frustration, not only in the disadvantaged sectors or the lower class sectors, but in the middle class sectors too. It's a question of the change in status that makes for frustration. Now, the other thing that Wes talks about is the way in which the culture, particularly the media, create the image of instant satisfaction, instant pleasure, that there is a sense that what's important is to have all of these materials and to get them instantly and to consume, and that this image of what it means to have status is by owning, by possessions, that this view of status, which is just present for the kids all the time, creates a great deal of frustration. It creates the expectation that somehow or other those materials will be present in their lives. And it leads also to kind of shortcuts. And much of the drug trade, in a way, can be assigned to the people becoming sellers of drugs in order to make the kind of money that allows them to have the instant gratifications that are portrayed all the time for them on television. West makes quite a little of this, that what it does in the face of the reality is to create a kind of hopelessness among people. Beg pardon?
It's a way of escaping reality.
So that it leads to drugs and alcoholism and other things in order to kind of blot out this lack of having status and having power and having position. And in the process, it undermines the role of families and churches and those institutions which try to help discipline and order life and prepare people. There's no way that I can think of that life is going to be very significant for people if they don't get a high school education. And you saw the dropout figures that that I was indicating. And they say 50% of the kids drop out of the schools in Chicago. At any rate, this works hardship, more hardship, one point I would make, on African Americans and other minority groups, about which Mark could tell us a great deal, the Native Americans, when they don't have the opportunities, the encouragement, and the culture that supports the the disciplining of oneself and the giving up of the immediate pleasure for the sake of a future. And so we have in our cities just almost hordes of people who are very frustrated and feel very much, particularly in the case of African Americans, I imagine Mark might say the same thing about Native Americans, of being discriminated against. And so the great American dream, couldn't help but think of this on 4th of July here, the great American dream of freedom and equality and the opportunity to pursue life and happiness doesn't seem very real. And in the face of that, you get all kinds of what we might call irrational behavior. Now, what I'm not interested in portraying, you know, a lot of very unhappy situations. I'm only interested in helping you, perhaps, to think about what all this means. What is the Christian imperative? What is God saying to us by virtue of this reality? And you can say, well, it's up to the individual. It's a matter, people are not victims. They make themselves their victim. They make themselves victims. They're responsible. But there's another sense in which the opportunities, the situation in which the circumstances are such that many are at a disadvantage. I remember a study growing up in River City by a friend of mine at the university, which said that by the time children were in the fifth grade, these students who were studying this town could predict what was going to happen to them, whether they were going to drop out of school, whether they were going to have a decent education, whether they were going to get married, whether they were going to have a stable marriage, whether they were going to have a job. They could predict this. In other words, a combination of their personal characteristics and of the social status of their families, the kind of families they grew up in terms of their opportunities and their successes, gave them the capacity to predict. And I'm only saying that in order to illustrate, from my point of view at least, that there's a great combination of personal history and the social circumstances of one and one's own individual life that cause one to be what one is. And nobody, it's a mystery. I mean, it's simply a mystery why we are what we are. And we can make a lot of statements, but there are certain factors that seem to be correlated with discipline, successful living, satisfactory living. And from my point of view, we live in a society which, by virtue of the economic and political and educational institutions, is not providing opportunities and circumstances and the kind of surrounding care and love that will produce disciplined, fairly well satisfied, productive, creative people. And you have to ask why. You have to ask why. What is it? What is it about our society that is responsible for this? And I can't tell you exactly, but I have asserted frequently that it's a whole philosophy of being which is encouraged by our schools, by our economic institutions, by our political institutions, which suggests that we're isolated individuals, that we have external relations to people. In other words, to have a view of being which is quite unchristian from my point of view. It simply is the opposite of what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, or what I think generally the biblical interpretation would give us. And certainly what I think is essential. Now, we have a community. We live in a community where we have a covenant to take care of each other and relate to each other and support each other. And as I say, I'm going to die in this community. I'm not going to be an isolated individual running around the country looking for great accomplishments and great material wealth. I'm set. Now, something might happen to cause me to change, but I can't imagine it. But most of the time, we are fragmented individuals, and our kids are all over the world, and everybody is seeking to find gratifications and successes without caring somehow and relating to a kind of root reality which represents both symbolically and actually the substance of the Christian faith. Now, I think with that, I'm going to stop and see what you think. I mean, I could go on at great length about the problems of our culture and quote statistics, but I think, is the point clear? Is it?
You missed one thing. It's the breaking down of the family. The togetherness of a family. A complete family. A mother, father, children. All working together.
Yeah, I heard a statistic the other day that only 13% of American families have two parents. I don't think that's right, but that seems too extreme. But it's very clear that the family. I was reading a study of Silicon County. There were a couple. It's a very serious sociological study of a couple of families in Silicon County and the effect of Silicon County. And it talked about there'd been two or three parents and the families got together and this one child said, "I have got too many relatives." I mean, the relatives are from all sides, three or four different persons in terms of the marriage relationship.
I probably have a couple comments, but...
Big pardon?
I probably have a couple comments, but I ended up, I'll start with this one, that for me as a Native American person, that both my brother and I were the first two to finish college he finished in 76 and I finished in 77. And we were able to do as Native Americans from a reservation in Western Washington was help be setting role models for our other Native American people on our reservation and working with the different colleges that we went to help work within the system of education and letting them know where Native American people do need to help or that we don't want to help and where we can help them understand how...
In other words, you provide a special access to your brothers and sisters.
For knowing how education can help Native American people. And the other probably point that I was when I was listening to you was that there's probably different avenues and levels of more or less what is considered poverty and where it's not always monetary or
right.
What you have or what you don't have.
That's a very good point.
How we as people on reservations where people come and stand there and look at, oh, you know, they must be so worn down or weighed down that when I go back to a reservation and to my reservation and to other reservations, their family structures are strong and it ends up maybe they don't have like a high income or a high...
You can't judge poverty by the monetary
amount or what they have and what they have not. I got a readout from Seattle, a 10-year readout that they understand because they have my Social Security number that they didn't know what my income level was for the last 10 years, and there was one year that they found out I only made $164 for the whole year. They said, "How do you live by that?" And I said, "I live right on the reservation. I live right with my family. And I didn't have to make any income to, because I as a family relationship on the reservation. The whole family takes care of the whole family. And for me to not have a job for 1 year, I was being taken care of by my family."
I was just thinking that the idea of individual, or just that term in all of its different forms, individuating for Jung, Western culture emphasizes the individual so much, and that's sort of seen as the pinnacle of development, the individual. Yeah, really, it does seem like there's been some distortion or perversion of that ideal, so that somehow in holding that up, we forget about all these other levels of who we are, you know, about all our connections to family and to the earth and to other peoples and other beings and other animals. Yeah, a real perversion of that whole ethic.
So that makes sense to you. I mean, that kind of interpretation of overemphasis.
Well, and a distortion. You know, that it's not really a whole. It's not really a whole being.
The other thing you have to say, of course, is that if you have what apparently was characteristic of the Eastern European society, where the freedom and the individualization and the individuality was oppressed, downplayed, you also got destruction. So that there's not a, from my point of view, there's a dialectic. There's a nice balance. And it's very clear to me that you've got to pay attention to yourself and develop yourself, or else you don't have anything to share with anybody. If you don't pay attention to your own development and get an education and get training and get something to be, then you don't have anything to be with and for in communion with you. So that it's a kind of a balance.
But to get to Donald Trump, I think we see now that that's not something that people hold up maybe the way they did 50 years ago. Now we can see that is something's gone funny.
Hear about Stacy.
No, I was just going to say we all listen to the media and advertisements and believe what they tell us. And these poor kids are just, what do I do, you know? It makes them more self-centered than they would be.
I just ran into an author, Jerry Mander, who's got a book out on why we should get rid of television. He was the head of an advertising firm. And he gave it all up. He's also got a book, In the Absence of the Sacred, which is an interesting book too.
I think we're stuck with television, and I think we're stuck with communication that happens now maybe in ways that were never possible even 10 years ago, and that everything is just instantaneous, and we're stuck with people maybe in at very low income levels and people at very high income levels, and that gap widening, and what do we do?
Yeah, the split between the high incomes and low incomes is increasing in this country.
And the consciousness of that split is also increasing. Yeah. It's right there.
I don't know what to do. I haven't turned the television on since 87. I will watch sometimes when somebody else got a program on that I want to see, mostly sports, but it's occasionally a program.
With the very kids that...
But I don't know what you do with the kids. I just have given up on television. And I know that there's some good things, but I am not going to spend my life with television.
Yeah, we aren't, but its influence is going to be there, and we can...
But what do the kids spend, 7 hours a day on the average or something like that? Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable.
So there's some great sermons on television. Wonderful, right? Ministers with really a lot they can bring home. I know there's a lot of them that's different, too. I know that's particularly for the money. There's no argument there. But they really are
somewhere. Yeah, I mean, it's ambiguous. I realize that I miss some things. But I'd read a book or pray or do something else rather than... I used to come home and I'd be tired after meetings. I'd go to a lot of meetings and I'd just flick, that television. And I have the image of my son flicking it from one station to another. And never stopping long enough from my point of view. Of course, he does have his favorite programs. There's a program out in Hollywood, 702 or something like that, that he watches all the time. But a lot of the time, it's a typical, what I'd call, cultural aberration of hoping that something will show up. I was talking about Gerrymander. Do you know his book, In the Absence of the Sacred?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I had read that. I've got it here.
I you should take a look at it.
Yeah.
Because it's on Native America. A lot. Half of it.
You mentioned that the other night.
Yeah, half of it's
on the lodge.
The way in which Native Americans used to look at things. I don't know whether they still do. Some do, I know.
Well, we do. I think in essence, a number of us do. It's a matter of us being able to understand that we are hearing what the sacredness is from the rocks, the trees, the animals. And, it's a matter of us being able to hear those messages.
So what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? What can we do in our churches?
Yell at them.
I've been trying to get our church to pay attention to the rest of the world a little bit, and we do pay attention to part of the world, to Central America. We've sent 25 people to Central America. We've had 2 sanctuary families. We have worked to try to understand what the United States policy is doing in Central America. We've got a group that's trying to relate to a Philippine church. I wrote to the pastor of the church. We're trying to at least listen to what's going on in some of the developing nations as a way of breaking down one of the great splits between the haves and the have-not nations of the world. Now, we've got the haves and the have-not people in our country, but we also have the haves and the have-not nations in the world. And I went to Rio to the Earth Summit, and the one thing that I came away with was the notion that somehow we had to take into account the fact, that in the sub-Sahara, the average income is $340 a year. And And our average income in the United States is $10,000. That's per person. I don't know exactly what you do about it, but somehow we have to ask the question, is this God's way of dealing with the world, with people, to have this kind of a situation? And if not, then what do we begin to do? And I've said that the least we can do is to take on a developing nation and take on some people in that nation and begin to relate to them so that part of our being makes sense out of this notion in Corinthians that what happens to other people happens to us. But if you somehow the knowing and the feeling, that's why I was so impressed with Leah's Vespers here when she did it on El Salvador, where she has spent years relating to people there who've been losing their family members, I would say in part because of U.S. policy, U.S. support for the military in El Salvador. We just had a member of our church who spent 3.5 years as the assistant to the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador. So we've got some sense of what the reality is there, but I have very little sense. I was in El Salvador about 10 hours one day. So I have, but somehow, one thing our churches can do is to promote the relationship with the people that somehow are the result of our system, of our national system and of our world system, so that it's harder not to take seriously what's happening to them. I don't know how you can take seriously what's happening to somebody if you don't know, if you don't have any connection with them. And you can't connect with very much. You've got to focus and connect with something. So I have this little piece. There's a document out here called On Living Toward the Future, and it's primarily oriented around the environmental issues, but on the back page I have this statement of how to become a Christian global citizen, or maybe it's just global citizenship. It grew out of a forum here last summer. So we're trying that, and we're trying in our church. We have some people in the Philippines, but it's very interesting. Our minister went to the Philippines, but he didn't relate any of us to the Philippines. He was our missionary. So often missionaries are there for our sakes, but they don't relate us to people. They don't become the vehicles for connecting us to that world, so that world becomes a part of us.